All right, world, welcome to tonight's episode of the Hot Widows Club podcast. My name is Crystal, and I am the Hot Widow of Eric. And with me tonight, I have Allie, the Hot Widow of Ross.
Hello.
And as a special treat on this episode following the Hot Widows Club podcast launch party is Connie, who is the Hot Widow of Ryan.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, you're welcome. I can't wait to learn more about Connie. One of the things that is so funny about Connie is that we met at the gym. And so I don't just go to Body by Trey. I also go to Orange Theory Fitness, which is a big part of my fitness journey. And I've known Connie for about 3 years, I think, right?
About maybe longer.
Yeah.
Probably longer because it'll be 3 years in November.
Oh, wow. Okay. So yeah, maybe.
So probably four and a half.
So at Orange Theory, we just have this shared love of one another. And so Connie and her husband both were members at the gym. And Ryan was the best because he was a dancer on the treadmill. So my friend Allison and I used to call him the tread dancer. And then I met Connie, and then it was just Ryan was a staple at the gym, as was Connie.
Ryan was a staple with all the ladies at the gym. In fact, at his funeral, there were ladies from the 845 class that, you know, didn't really know I existed and were kind of sad that I did. So he had a great wife who afforded him a lot of opportunities, mostly to work out at 845 in the morning with all of the stay-at-home moms from West Omaha. So he was really popular in that group.
That doesn't surprise me. That does not surprise me. So one day I'm at the gym. And I'm in the back of the studio and I'm with Connie. We're both Jack and Steel, as you know, just pumping iron. And I turn to Connie and I say, "Hey, Connie, where's Ryan been?" And Connie just looks at me and goes, "Huh, funny to ask. He was diagnosed with cancer." And I said, "No shit. So was Eric. You gotta be fucking kidding me." And so began our cancer journey together.
Yeah, it was really weird. It was at about the exact same time.
Yeah.
Not great. No. Not a great. I mean, icebreaker for sure. Jack and Steel breaker for sure.
Yeah, and except your Jack and Steel, make sure you just start talking about how your husband has cancer. It's a great way to break that set up. So anyway, so Connie, tell us about your cancer journey.
So I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing, but our cancer journey was really, really, really short, really brief. Came out of nowhere, kind of. You know, which I've learned is not really unusual, especially when you're talking about young people with cancer. But I mean, Ryan was in great shape. You know, like you, he, you know, did Body by Trey. I mean, he worked out two or three times a day. He was a college athlete. I mean, he played football and baseball in college. You know, he had really, in the last couple of years before he ultimately died, had gotten probably in the best shape of his life since he was in college. You know, it was just one of those things where in the spring of 2019. And it was a really cold winter that year. And I wouldn't remember that other than how it leads into the story. But he was coaching our son's baseball team, and you know, baseball in Nebraska in the spring, it's generally really cold outside. And so he just kind of had a cold and a cough, and just generally wasn't feeling well for most of, I would say, you know, March or April. You know, he'd feel a little better for a little bit. You know, he'd take some congestion stuff, or, you know, he got a steroid shot once and he just, you know, couldn't really shake it. And I remember we had a trip coming up to Napa. We love to go to Napa. We try to go every year with our big group of friends. And that trip was coming up and he's like, I can't wait to get out to California. It's going to be warmer and I can finally, you know, be able to, you know, kick this cold or whatever it is I have. So we go out to our trip to Napa, and that was it's the Kentucky Derby weekend. So the first weekend of May, we go out there. It's a great trip. I mean, you know what happens when you go to Napa? I mean, we're drinking essentially all day for 4 or 5 days in a row. You know, since we both love fitness so much, we got up in the morning and we ran our 5 miles down to the square and, you know, worked out, and he was okay. You know, everything was, you know, moderately fine, but we got back from the trip and again, he just wasn't feeling better. It's actually really a long story, way too much to get into this, you know, one episode, but one of our great friends who was actually on the trip is a nurse practitioner. And she's like, "Oh, you know, if you don't feel better, you know, just come in and see me." And Ryan, you know, I don't want to make a general statement about most men, but Ryan didn't really ever go to the doctor. Everything was fine, you know, and And she, our friend, basically told him, you know, if you're not feeling better, you're going to have to come in and see me. And so it was a Saturday night, and that friend and her husband and their family were over for dinner, and Ryan still wasn't feeling well. And we were, you know, drinking and having dinner and hanging out. And I mean, I specifically remember, you know, she had an IV in her car. And so, I mean, she hooked up an IV. She's like, oh, you probably seen fluids. You're probably dehydrated. The next day, Sunday, was Mother's Day. And we went to brunch, and he was kind of grouchy the whole time. And obviously, looking back, he didn't feel well. But I mean, it was Mother's Day. Like, why couldn't he rise to the occasion and, you know, be my bartender, you know, clean up the house, right, do all the things? And so he told me, he's like, well, if I'm not feeling better, I'll go see our friend, you know, on Monday. So I leave for work Monday morning. I get a text from him. He says, I'm at our friend's office. She's running some tests. You know, I'll let you know. I didn't really hear anything. A couple hours later, he's like, ugh, our friend is making me go up to the hospital for x-rays. He's like, you know, she just wants to figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. So I said, it's fine. It's, you know, everything is okay. Just let me know if I need to go pick up the kids, I will. Because he usually picked up the kids from school. And so he called and he said, it's going to be a while at the hospital. Why don't you just plan on getting the kids? And so I told my boss, hey, I have to leave early today. I'm going to go get the kids. You know, Ryan's up getting some x-rays. We're trying to figure out what's going on. So I go pick up the kids. I don't really think too much about it. And about 4:15 or 4:30, this friend calls me and she says, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm getting ready to make dinner. I got the kids. I'm like, what's up? She's like, why don't you bring the kids over to my house? You know, my babysitter's there and, you know, she can stay with the kids and I'm going to have you come down to my office.
What'd you say?
It's not appropriate even for radio, but I'm kind of like, hey, you know, what's going on?
Right.
You know, it's me. Tell me. She's like, no, I just really need you to come down. And so I'm like, well, this isn't great. You know, whatever it is, isn't great. And so it's rush hour in West Omaha. So I'm trying to get over to her office. Ryan is, of course, texting me, you need to get here. She won't tell me anything until you get here. Well, it took me, you know, too long to get there. And so I walk into her office, which is closed. And so it's just her and Ryan's in there and he won't look at me. He won't make eye contact with me. So it's reaffirming whatever this news is not great. And so I walk in and this is one of our best friends who, you know, we are very close with, who we, you know, hang out with socially, who is a great friend to Ryan, who is a great friend to me, who loves our children. And she basically has to be the one to tell us, you know, something isn't right. You know, you need to actually go and, you know, see this doctor and whatever, because whatever they had found on the x-rays, the chest x-rays indicated probably tumors. But, you know, she's not a doctor and she's obviously not an oncologist, but she knew enough that, you know, something was wrong. And so that was Monday. And so we made appointments with a GI doctor and, you know, some other things to kind of get to the bottom of it. And, you know, really long story short, he got in for a scope on Wednesday. So 2 days later, and irony, his GI doctor is the husband of one of my high school friends.
Oh, no.
So again, it's a very small interconnected world, whether it's good or bad. Like we are in all of our shit together.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, Ryan is coming out of anesthesia and I'm sitting in the room and our doctor friend comes in again, can't look at me and bursts into tears. And I'm thinking, gosh. Okay, seriously? Like, come on, like, you're the doctor.
Keep it together, bro.
Keep it together. Get, you know, and he's just like, I mean, all he could say was, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. He's like, it's not good. And I'm kind of like, oh, okay. And he's like, obviously, you know, we don't have the pathology back yet. He's like, but here's what I think's going on. He's like, he's got a big tumor at the junction of where his esophagus meets his stomach. And, you know, it seems based on what I saw on the CAT scan, or I'm sorry, on the CT scan and the, you know, it's spread everywhere. So that's Wednesday. Friday, you know, he sees another doctor, some other stuff. And I remember he got the results and he was trying to call me from like the treetop escapes. He was on a field trip with the kids. And so he's literally like in the middle of like the treetop ropes course or something. And
only Ryan.
Right. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, self, if you have like stage 4 cancer through your body now, like, are you really like supposed to be on a ropes course that requires a moderate amount of strength? And if you fall, something really bad could happen. But, you know, those are questions that
Ryan knew no limit.
Right. He was not willing to entertain. So I just didn't really ask. But long story short, it went from him going to see a friend because he just couldn't shake this cold to he had stage 4 esophageal cancer that had spread by the time they discovered it to his liver, to innumerable spots on his liver.
Wow.
You know, all throughout his, you know, stomach, in his bones.
Oh my gosh.
So it was a pretty gut-wrenching diagnosis.
Yeah.
And I mean, it sets with your, as you know, like what do you do with that? What do you say with that? And so that's, you know, kind of where we were. We went from everything's fine and Ryan just hasn't felt well and he's cranky to, oh, okay, so we're going to do this now.
Right. I remember those days too. Did you just kind of feel like everything was a blur around you, but you had so much adrenaline?
Yeah. I would say sort of. Just because I have a lot of experience with cancer in my family. My mom was diagnosed with breast cancer very young and then passed away, you know, pretty young, as did her mom. We have a lot of, you know, cancer in our family. And so I actually thought that I knew a lot about cancer and how, you know, how I would respond, how it would affect us. And I can tell you, like, in the moment when you're actually there, it was completely different than what I expected. Right. And in fact, I mean, we had this conversation and this will probably play into the story as our journey, you know, comes out. But I had always assumed that if somebody was going to get cancer, you know, in our relationship and potentially die young, it would be me, because genetics and history kind of played that out. And so never in a million years did I ever think that anything would happen to Ryan. And so sitting with the reality that he has this horrible diagnosis, and I did do all of the things that they tell you not to do. You know, I did, you know, kind of Google and like see what was out there. Because I had never really heard of esophageal cancer. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't really know what that meant. And I will tell you, when I Googled that and I saw that the 5-year expectancy or life expectancy rate for that was like less than 10%, that's when the bottom dropped out for me, because I was like, oh.
I was the same way. Eric had a gene mutation called TP53, which basically when you Google it with the rest of his mutation panel was simply turn the other way and run, because you have no chance at beating this. And even Eric's doctor was like, it's a tough one. It's a really tough one. So he had prepped me really early on to know that my journey was going to be our journey. Like my life, when I say my journey, I meant my time with my husband was going to be limited and his journey was going to be short.
So we never really got that. There was no conversation that Ryan and I had with an oncologist or with a doctor or frankly with anybody who had medical training who had that conversation with us. I had that knowledge and I had that conversation with his, you know, care nurse and, you know, his oncologist, but he never did and he didn't want to have that conversation with me. And that was a hard component of it, because I was living in this reality that I felt like I was in alone.
Oh no.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, you know, Ryan was going to beat it. Everything was going to be fine. It was going to be a tough, you know, couple of, you know, name your period of time, 6 months, a year, you know, 2 years, but he was going to beat it and everything was going to be fine. When I had, you know, this knowledge, I immediately went to, okay, how am I going to survive? How am I going to get through this? And what's next? Because I'm going to have to figure that out. And so I was there pretty early in our journey. But again, you know, to kind of, you know, spoiler alert, Ryan got diagnosed again the week after Mother's Day. So middle of May in 2019. And he died 6 months later.
Gosh, Connie.
He died in November of 19. So there wasn't, even if we had ever kind of gotten to that space, what do you do in 6 months? Like, what do you literally do if somebody comes in and says, oh yeah, you're awesome, you're fun, like you've had a great life so far. Yeah, you got 6 months.
My gosh. Allie, did you, when you and Ross were going through your journey, did you guys ever have an opportunity to kind of talk about like how long you guys thought that you were going to have?
We were never given a timeline. At the beginning, the very, very beginning, when Ross was diagnosed, we met with an oncologist who was assigned to us at the university here. And that oncologist immediately told us, hey, this isn't good. Ross probably has 2 years to live. And Ross and I left that appointment and we said, we can't be with her. We couldn't do it. We felt so...
I bet you that was our doctor.
Yeah?
We can talk offline. Okay.
So we immediately switched because we were like, no. And so then the new doctor never gave us a timeline, never told us. Like, it was always so positive because for the most part, we had a pretty positive journey, I guess. You can say that in cancer, but... It wasn't until we had tried everything that the doctors, his surgical oncologist, which you guys all know we call the quarterback, and his oncologist were like, there's nothing else we can do, but we can try to extend his life as much as possible with these chemo pills. Yeah.
We never got a timeline either. Our doctor never said, you have any sort of timeline. Mine was all like Connie's, which was a lot of Google searching because I wasn't just going to sit back. I didn't Google much. I Googled the one time I knew enough to be dangerous.
Well, and to be fair, that's what you want, right? Nobody has an expiration date that anybody can predict.
True.
And frankly, that's how Ryan wanted it. And it was fine for him and his journey to be positive and not talk about it, not talk about things as long as things are going well. But when he started to not feel well and, you know, when the treatments weren't working, I think the lack of communication, you know, was probably not as helpful. And so I would say for me and the way that I kind of process things, the way that I have to have structure in my life and the way that I knew that at some point it was going to just be me, I think that I probably started to grieve the loss of Ryan even before he died. Mm. And when I think back on that, I don't know if I had the chance to do it differently, if I would, because maybe I would have been kind of, you know, more present and just trying to, enjoy every day or, you know, some other cliche that makes sense to some people. I don't know. But I immediately kind of went to, okay, we're going to do what we're doing here to try to give him as much time as we can possible to try to make him comfortable. But I need to start thinking about how I'm going to get the kids through this. How am I going to get me through this? Mm-hmm. What am I going to do with my job? You know, how are we going to deal with our families? You know, how is his family going to react? How is my family going to react? How are we going to do all of this?
Yeah.
And as you know, there's no guidebook.
There's no
what not to do when you're diagnosed with stage 4 cancer.
Right.
I mean, I feel like I could write that book now, but it's just tough. And I mean, our kids at the time were, gosh, it would have been 9 and 12, you know? So yeah. So 3 years younger than they are now almost. And, Ryan was really adamant that, he wanted to let them know that he had cancer, but he was going to fight it and everything was going to be okay. I wasn't necessarily on board with the messaging, but I figured at that point it wasn't my message to deliver, yeah, right?
He was
going to set the tone and, you know, that's what we were going to do. And so we decided that night, I mean, because some of our friends knew, and not that, you know, we thought that our friends would, you know, say, but we knew we had to tell the kids right away because we didn't want them to hear from anybody else,
right,
besides us. And so we called a family meeting, which looking back, I would not do that because now anytime I say family meeting, the kids are like, oh my gosh,
what's happening?
What horrible thing is being, you know, thrust upon us now.
Right.
So we had a family meeting and actually, you know, this is kind of heartbreaking, but Ryan couldn't tell the kids. I mean, he was not at the point where like those words could come out of his mouth and he wouldn't be able to deliver the news. So I told the kids. Apparently, I don't know, I guess I am just a better deliverer of bad news.
Right.
But I don't think he wanted to scare the kids
right,
unnecessarily. And I think that he was still at a point where if he would have had to say it out loud to the kids, there's no way he could have gotten through it.
Right.
So we sat the kids down and I said, hey, you know, we've been going to the doctor a lot this week and we got some news that we want to talk to you about. You know, dad has cancer. And my kids have, I mean, they know what cancer is. Unfortunately, you know, like I said, we've got a lot of it in my family. But Ryan having cancer looked different to them because it was always a grandparent mm-hmm. or somebody who was a little bit older. And so they just didn't really know what it meant. And so, you know, we kind of told them, well, dad's going to, you know, take some treatment. You know, he may be tired. He may be sick. You know, he may be, you know, whatever. And, you know, that's it. And they didn't really ask any questions. And that was kind of the end of the family talk about it. And so I would say, looking back on our journey, most of the questions that I have about whether I did things the right way dealt with how much the kids were involved, how much they knew, what we told them, what we didn't yeah. tell them. And so, frankly, it was the summer and kids are busy in the summer. Our kids are extra busy all the time, but really in the summer. And so we tried to keep their lives as normal as possible, keep them busy, keep them engaged with their friends, and not really have anything about Ryan's sickness or diagnosis affect the way that they lived. Again, when I think about things that I would have done differently, I mean, I remember sitting at a swim meet on Father's Day, and it was the Father's Day of 2019. And after the swim meet, you know, asking our daughter, what do you want to do after this? Do you want to have a barbecue with dad? Do you want to do this? She's like, yeah, no, not really. And I remember asking Ryan, like, what do you want to do for dinner? Do you want to do something really nice? Do you want to do something special? He's like, I might go golfing. Oh. And I mean, I remember sitting in the bleachers at that swim meet thinking to myself, this could be their last Father's Day together. And nobody seems to be aware of this fact except for me. Right. And so it just kind of goes back to what I told you about. Like, I felt like I sat in a period of acknowledgement and grief much, much longer than either the kids or even Ryan, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had the same experience. I felt like I was grieving way before Ross was, way before. I mean, I don't even know if my kids you would consider grieving right now, but I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. I remember a moment, and this is really sad. And I mean, I have to be honest, that's what this podcast is all about. I was sitting in the car. It was the winter of 2020, and that was a really cold winter too. It was freezing. And I had to take Eric back and forth to the med center for blood transfusions. I took him in 2 to 3 times a day. And I remember sitting in the car talking to my friend Allison, who's a nurse. And I remember saying, Allison, I'm so tired. I can't do this anymore. He's so sick. I can't even get him out of bed. He's throwing up. I have to put him in a wheelchair. I'm wheeling him in there. He looks dead. He feels dead. I'm dead. This whole life is dead to me right now. And she goes, stop wishing him gone because it's going to be way harder when he's gone. But that like a moment that I knew that it was over, I was just like grieving. I was grieving like, my gosh, probably from October when we were in California until February when he passed away.
I think, again, our journey was pretty short, the 6 months. And frankly, the first 2 or 3 months were fine-ish. You know, he didn't really look very sick. He was still able to do some things.
He still went to OTF.
Still went to Orange Theory. I mean, still played a lot of golf. You know, just kind of did as much as he could do because that's what he wanted to do. I mean, I think the saddest part for me as I watch this, besides the obvious sad stuff, like, you know, my husband's dying and my children's father is dying. I think the saddest thing for Ryan was that, I mean, his body was failing him, right? And Ryan was, you know, he was a great athlete. He was a great competitor. He could will his body to do a 5-minute mile.
He could.
On the mile benchmark, which not a lot of people do at Orange Theory. And he couldn't make his body, you know, and the fact that his body failed him, you know, ultimately, I think was probably the hardest thing for me to watch him acknowledge and, you know, kind of take in. It's pretty sad.
Yeah, that is really, really hard to see the one you love just kind of fade away in front of you and know that their mind is still there and they don't want to be doing this. They don't want to put you through that. I know, Allie, you've talked about just being so sad about Ross having to go through the journey. I think as a widow, watching your husband go through that, they're supposed to be, not supposed to be, in my house, he was, but this strong, stable, healthy man. And to watch them just slowly fade away into something that they're not was the hardest part for me. He didn't want that.
Yes. I've said this a lot, is that the hardest part was watching somebody who is incredibly strong, incredibly young, has honestly their whole life ahead of them. We have young kids. His career was taking off. Just everything was how we had planned it, right? Mm-hmm. And to watch his body fail, to watch him literally look age, it's crazy, the process of dying. I just remember the week of hospice, and it went very quickly, but it was like I was watching my husband, my 36-year-old husband, turn into like an 80, 90-year-old man, like the way he started to appear. And it's not something anybody ever warned me about.
Well, yeah, I can't. And I don't know that you wanted anybody to warn you either, right? You don't want to know that's coming.
Mm-mm. No. Ugh.
But it was traumatic. Yes. And it was also very traumatic for Ross. You know, he still had his mind up until the very end. And, you know, he continued to work up until the very end. And so he was so aware of what was happening. And that's what crushed me.
Yeah. My gosh. So 2 weeks, was it 2 weeks before Ryan died? Maybe it was three because he was in a hospital for a week. But so maybe 3 weeks before Ryan died, the first weekend of November, our daughter had cotillion. And so what they do at cotillion is, you know, she's a girl. So she put on a fancy dress and, you know, her parents go. And Ryan was really sick that day. It was a Saturday. And I said, you know, maybe you shouldn't go. You know, it's fine. You know, I'll take her. It'll be okay. You know, you don't like the rubber chicken and, you know, having to sit and watch her do the dance. And he was very adamant. He's like, no, I'm going to go. And I remember him in his closet trying to get dressed to go. So to put on the suit. Well, first of all, the suit was way too big for him now. It was, you know, one of his favorite suits, but he's, you know, putting it on. And I mean, just struggling to put his socks on, you know, struggling to, and he wouldn't let me help him, you know, because, well, you know why. I mean, he just wouldn't let me help him. And he really looked like he was in a lot of pain. Mm-hmm. And so I was worried from a million perspectives about why it's probably not a good idea for him to go. But, he, you know, like usual, he was going to do what he was going to do. And he went. And a lot of our friends were there because, you know, there were friends from school and friends from our parish. And one of our good friends came up to me, you know, midway at the dance. And she's like, oh, my gosh. She's like, how's Ryan? I'm like, I don't know. You know, fine. She goes, when I saw him walk in, it was like I got punched in the gut. And so from my perspective, like being in the thick of it, you know, I knew that, you know, he was, you know, getting thinner and, you know, losing his hair and starting to look, you know, that way that. You know, somebody looks when they're at the end stages of their cancer journey, but you don't really notice it until somebody points it out to you. Long story short, you know, he made it through the night relatively fine. He got to dance with our daughter. There are pictures of that moment. There are videos of that moment. And actually the pictures, the formal pictures that they took at cotillion that night came back 2 days after he died.
Oh my gosh.
And so, you know, I see these pictures and I'm like, oh, this is why it was important for him to go, mm-hmm. you know, because I mean,
yes.
And so she has those memories and, you know, we have that picture up and, you know, it doesn't really look like her dad, but you know, that's the last time, you know, she danced with him and she was with him and that's why it was important for him to be there.
Connie, that isn't like, that story is crazy that you only got that short period of time. I remember Ryan's last couple of weeks. Do you feel comfortable kind of sharing when he was in the hospital and didn't want to end his life there? And
sure, sure. So cotillion, that was that week. And then the next week, you know, he was still actively getting treatment when he could. You know, there's only one time that his numbers were low enough that they sent him home. So it was the second week of November and he was in at the med center, you know, for his appointment. And he had started to develop fluid buildup on his abdomen and things like that, that I was convinced that it was this treatment that we were going to go to. And the oncologist was going to say, you know, there's not really anything we can do for you. You know, mm-hmm. it's probably time, but for some reason that didn't happen. He wasn't able to get treatment that day. And they had talked about potentially doing a scan, I think maybe of his head. You know, we never really got any kind of confirmation of whether or not the cancer had spread to his brain. I kind of thought it might have just because he was becoming a little bit more disoriented and couldn't really remember things. And, you know, just wasn't able to, I just remember I went into the room one night and he was just looking at his phone and he didn't know what to do with it. Like he couldn't either couldn't remember the password or didn't know that you needed a password to open it. And so I was really noticing, you know, some significant decline, you know, but he was at home and, you know, he was in our bedroom and our bedroom is on the second floor. And so at that point, I didn't, you know, feel I didn't like him walking up and down stairs. You know, I just, it all made me very anxious. It all made me very nervous because, I mean, frankly, if he were to fall, I don't think that I could have picked him up. But, you know, he made it through that week. But then like that Friday or Saturday, I mean, he just wasn't sleeping well and he was really agitated during the night, was kind of up all night and up and down. But then when he'd get up, you know, he would kind of fall out of bed or, I mean, it was just making me really nervous. And so I called the nurse and she's like, well, you know, see what he's like tomorrow, you know, give us a call if anything changes. And so long story short, that weekend was just really one of the worst weekends. I was just, you know, something just didn't feel right. He was off. He was really agitated. And so sent the kids off to school Monday morning and I called his nurse and I'm like, you know, this isn't good. You know, something just isn't right. And so she's like, well, do you think that you can get him in the car, you know, or do I need to send an ambulance? And I was like, well, I'm going to try to get him in my car because if an ambulance comes, like he might murder me and then we'll, you know, have two problems because he just, I mean, he wasn't interested in anything like that, which I mean, I get it. So she called ahead to the emergency room to let them know that, you know, we are coming in. We get to the emergency room on Monday. It takes forever to get him admitted. Now, this is pre-COVID, thank goodness. So this is November of 2019. So we get there, you know, he goes in, they're giving him a bunch of fluids. It turns out that he has an infection in the fluid that's, you know, on his abdomen, probably, you know, in his lungs and things like that. And so they say they're going to have to admit him. He was not pleased about this, but I think at that point he was just not feeling, you know, well at all. And so he was hoping, oh yeah, if I get some fluids or if I get, you know, some medicine, I'll feel better and then I'll go home and everything will be fine. So they admit him on Monday night to the cancer center hospital downtown. And so I call his parents just to let his parents know, like, hey, you know, I've got, you know, Ryan, you know, we're at the hospital. And so they decide to come up to stay with the kids. And so that's actually, you know, perfect. Fine. Right. Come up and take care of that. So that was Monday. Long story short, he was in the ICU all week. And so, you know, so he was there Monday, Tuesday, you know, they admit him, they try to get his infection under control. But I mean, you know, his blood pressure is low. There's just all sorts of things that are not going right. But until they could get the infection under control, they couldn't address, you know, the laundry list of other issues. You know, his parents came up to the hospital to see him once. And I don't think it was probably good for either one of them. You know, Ryan didn't want his parents to see him like that. His parents didn't really like seeing him like that. And so it was just really emotional for everybody. Where that was just something that was kind of harder for them anyway. I mean, just things like, you know, I'm sure you remember this, you know, when the doctor comes into the room, you have to, you know, tell him your name and your birth date. You know, Ryan was just, you know, the tumors were, you know, so advanced in his esophagus. I mean, he just even struggled to say, you know, just his name, you know, and his birthday. It was just hard. It's just sad. He also had an issue with, he hadn't really eaten anything all week. And so there was the nutrition issue. And so they talked about, you know, were they going to put a tube, you know, down his throat to feed him? Were they going to just try to, you know, do it remotely? And it was at that point that one of the infectious disease doctors, you know, kind of pulled me out into the room or out into the hallway. And he's like, hey, what's your plan here? And I was like, I don't know. You tell me, you know, what is the plan? And he's like, well, you know, I think that he's probably actively dying. And he's like, so you guys need to figure out when enough is enough. And he goes, have you had that conversation? And I said, well, actually we haven't. He's never really been ready to have that conversation. And I certainly wasn't going to bring it up. I wasn't going to start that conversation. And he goes, okay. So he leaves, he goes back into the room. I have no idea to this day what that doctor said to him or how that conversation, you know, played out. But the doctor came back out and he said, he's doing this for you. you know, he thinks that's what, you know, you want. And he just, you know, he'll do whatever. And I was like, oh, well, I mean, I can fix that. I can fix that real easy. You know? And so I went in, I'm like, Ryan, if you are done and you don't want to do this, you just tell me and I'll make it happen. And, you know, at that point he was kind of like, yeah, you know, it's probably, I mean, they tried to put the tube, I think it's like a J tube, the one that goes up their nose and down. And, yeah. And I mean, that was awful. And, you know, he was, you know, not really lucid, and it was just, you know, it wasn't good. And if the reality was he was, you know, it was about time and he didn't want to do it and he was doing it for us. I mean, I kind of went in, I'm like, you know, don't do this, you know, for me. I'll be okay. The kids will be okay. I will figure this out. Like, you don't have to worry about that. And I told him that. And I did mean it in that moment, because I didn't want him hanging on and doing things if it was time to go. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, yeah, that's fine. And so I went home. That was Thursday night. And that was the first night I slept at home. And I just remember how good it felt not to be in the hospital. Like, how good it felt to, like, sleep at home and to be away from that. Like, oh my God, this is so much better. And then I thought to myself, okay, if I feel this way, like, I can't even imagine what he feels like. Like, he didn't want to be in the hospital. He earned himself a babysitter his first night there because he, like, tried to get up and run away.
Oh, Ryan.
So, yeah, we had a sitter there to make sure he wasn't a flight risk. And he just kind of, you know, he just wanted to come home. And so luckily, I had a really resourceful group of friends who had connections with the director of a local hospice place. And so on Friday, you know, I went there Friday morning with the plan that, you know what, we were going to spring him from the hospital. He was going to come home and whatever happened was going to happen. And so I told the doctor, I'm like, you know, we want to leave. And he's like, well, you know, I don't know if that's a good idea. And I'm like, well, I'm sorry. I wasn't aware that we were prisoners here. You know, we're going to go home. He's like, well, if you do that, you have to call hospice and you have to do X and you have to do Y and you have to do Z. And, you know, the weekend's coming up. So I think the earliest you could get this done is Monday. I'm like, yeah, we're going to leave and we're going to leave today. Like, that's how it's going to go. And so we had to get a couple things, you know, taken care of and stuff. But I remember going in and telling Ryan, hey, we're going to go home. And he thought we were lying to him, right? He's like, this is a joke, you know, whatever. And then I actually had two of his really good friends that he grew up with, so some of his childhood buddies who lived in Missouri, came up to see him. And he's like, what are they doing here? I'm like, well, they're going to help me take you home. And, you know, he's like, what? I mean, he just, you know. And so in order to get him out of there, we had to, you know, again, get hospice on board. And we had to agree that we were going to do all these things. And he had to have an ambulance service get him home. And so we did that. And he got home probably about 3 p.m. on Saturday. So yeah, I was a day off. So it was Saturday morning. I'm like, yeah, we're springing him out of here. And they're like, yeah, you can't do that. It's the weekend. I'm like, oh, we're going to do it. So he got home about 3 o'clock on that Saturday. And I had told his parents he was, you know, getting out of the hospital. And so his parents and his brother and sister were on the way up and met us at our house on Saturday. My sisters and, you know, my family were there. You know, we got him home and he literally sent out a text to like his group of guy friends, like his close group of friends. And he's like, you know, hey, everybody, I'm out. Or, you know, said something kind of funny that he got sprung. And he sent a selfie of himself, which was, by the way, an awful, awful picture. You know, somebody showed that to me and I was like, oh,
what was he thinking?
Right. But he sent a selfie of himself to his friends and said, I got sprung, you know, come over and visit. And so like that Saturday night, I mean, I wouldn't say we had a party, but Ryan kind of held court in the living room, you know, in this armchair and had his best, closest friends there and, you know, their wives and, you know, their kids were kind of there and everybody was kind of talking to him and, you know, really just chatting. I mean, he asked me to make him scrambled eggs. I mean, he hadn't eaten in over a week.
Wow.
But he said he was hungry for scrambled eggs. So I made him some scrambled eggs. He had a couple bites. I kicked everybody out of the house at 10. You know, so his parents went, you know, to the basement to sleep. His sister was upstairs in our bedroom. I was in the hospice bed, you know, that we had set up at the living room. You know, he was in the armchair. And then my friend, you know, our friend who helped us with the initial diagnosis was there too, because she was going to administer the meds and do that sort of stuff to make sure I didn't have to do it. The hospice nurse was set to show up Sunday morning at 8. So she could go through like how to use the latrine and how to do all these things and, you know, whatever. And I mean, long story short, I mean, he died overnight. He died just after 3 o'clock. You know, he'd got up every hour to, you know, administer his meds and do some other things. And I was with my mom in the room, you know, when she died. And so I kind of knew, like, you know, when you get to that, you know, point, there's, you know, the what do they call it? Like the rattling, like the breathing and stuff.
Strider breaths.
Yeah. And so, you know, we were with him downstairs and, you know, that's how, you know, that's how it went down. But I mean, he called his shot. He went out exactly the way he planned it. He was not about to have that hospice person, you know, come to the house. He did not want to make this a long, extended, awful thing, as, right, you know, for the kids, or for anybody else. And that's how it was.
My gosh, what a story. Thanks for sharing that.
Yes, thank you.
That takes a lot to share those moments because they're hard. You start thinking about them, especially as you have, you know, you start to work towards a path forward and you start to go back and you relive that trauma. It's really healthy. Like, yeah. I think it's very healthy to tell the story and to tell it over and over and over again. But it doesn't, for me, I don't know if it does for you guys, it doesn't change like the gut sinking feeling that happens when I tell it. It gets easier.
Yeah.
But even at, you know, I'm what am I, 16, 18 months now, it still hurts my heart to tell it.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, and you kind of leave out, you know, there are funny parts. There are really sad parts. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, millions of anecdotes that go into those stories. But, you know, the ultimate ending is always the same. And so, you know, you just, you tell the story and that's the story.
Yeah. It does end the same way, right? All at the end of the day, we all say, and it happened. One thing that Connie said, I think, Ali, you and I have both said, is that the message that when our husbands were dying was the same. I'm going to be okay. I've got this under control. The kids are going to be okay. I love you. It's time when you're ready. I know that we've both talked about saying, having that, some sort of similar messaging. I'm okay. This is going to be okay. So like when Eric was dying, like he kept telling me, I don't want to leave you. I don't want to leave you. Oh, I just remember him like saying, I don't want to leave you. I don't want to leave you. And I'm saying, I'm okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to be okay. Mm-hmm. I am a badass. I've got this under control. Yeah. You've seen me. And then shortly thereafter, it was like, okay, we did it.
Right. Yeah.
We are badass women.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, anybody at hospice will tell you, I mean, whether it's your spouse or, you know, your parent or, you know, somebody, like that's a very important part of the journey, mm-hmm. right? Like you have to tell them it's okay to go. Like you have to do it. You don't want to.
No, no, that's the worst, having to say that and to have that messaging out there. It's something I hope no one has to ever go through. But those of you who've gone through it, you know. You know what it's like to hear that. And when Connie just said it, it just reminded me again of what it was like to say it.
But they're stubborn, right? I mean, I had to be like, listen, go. You know, we got this. I mean, is it going to be easy? No. But I mean, that, you know, at that point, all they need to know is that you're going to be okay, because that's probably, you know, what they worry about.
Yeah.
1,000%.
So Connie, I wanted to ask you, how does the path forward look? How long has it been now?
Well, so Ryan died in November of 19. And so it'll be 3 years, you know, this November, but it's not really 3 years because COVID happened. Mm-hmm. And then COVID was like this weird time for us where even though it was awful in some respects, it was actually probably perfect for us, right? Because for my kids, their world completely stopped. Everything changed and everything was different. And then like starting in March, like it kind of stopped for everybody. And so it gave us kind of this time where we couldn't do anything else but be together. Right. And so it was really, I mean, I hate COVID so much and I don't want to talk about it being a gift, but I mean, it was really a gift for us to have that time together to try to figure out who we were now, what we were going to do. But most importantly, that we were going to be okay. I mean, it was going to be different. And it wasn't going to look the same and it wasn't going to feel the same, but we were going to be okay. And I did something really stupid and got another dog in February of 2020. So that was awful.
Something with dogs.
She did not inspire me to get a dog.
Well, so again, side note into the story, you know, I had a double mastectomy and reconstruction in January of 2020, which, you know, kind of fills into the cancer story. I had mentioned earlier, I always thought if somebody was going to get sick, it was going to be me. When Ryan got diagnosed, I finally got some advanced genetic testing done, found out that I had basically a 50-50 chance of getting breast cancer. Well, for me,
oh my gosh,
knowing the space that I was going to be in, it was a no-brainer. It was, well, I'm going to do this. This is what I'm going to do. And in fact, my original surgery date was the day after Ryan's funeral. So I was supposed to do that. Obviously, we pushed it back a couple of weeks. In fact, it was really funny. The night after the funeral, one of my doctor friends texted me and said, hey, I had in my calendar that you're doing this surgery tomorrow. She's like, I'm just calling to make sure you're not. And I was like, come on. She's like, I figured it'd be a lot, but I know you. And I thought, you know, you might go through with it. So thank you for telling me you're putting it off for a little bit. So I did. But I mean, I just didn't have a choice, right? Mm-hmm. I felt like I had to do that. So I did everything that I could to proactively reassure the kids that, you know, I obviously can't control everything, but the things that I can control, you know, I'm going to make sure that as much as it, you know, pains you, I'm going to torment you for as long as I can on this earth. So that's what was really hard with the kids right afterwards, is that they were so scared they were going to lose me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's probably normal for, you know, kids who experience the loss of a parent. You know, they become, I mean, we're all they have left.
Right.
Right.
And so, I mean, they know what the plan is and it ain't great if I go. So they're really interested in you know, me being relatively healthy and alive until at least they, you know, get out the door and establish their own lives. And so that was hard. And it's such a cliche, but really the path forward is best focused on time. I mean, this year is better than last year was. This month is better than last month was. You know, they get older, and as they start to really believe again that their lives aren't going to markedly change, I think that's what they try so hard to preserve and to protect, is that they've had the worst thing that could ever happen to a child happen to them. That happened. And so they don't want anything else to change. It's like nothing else can, you know, throw them off. They have, everything has to stay the exact same. And so guiding them through that and, you know, just getting them to where they are now has been a combination of time, a lot of like really tough conversations. And as awful as this sounds, you know, we've actually had a couple other instances in our close friend group and in our school community and our parish where, you know, my son probably has more people in his class that have lost a parent to death or to cancer than he has divorced parents.
Wow.
So knowing that they're not alone and that they didn't do anything to make this happen to them, and that bad things happen to really good people all the time. And they've seen that play out. And as heartbreaking as that is, that's powerful for them to know that not only are they not alone in this, but they can actually really be helpful and reach out to other kids that they know that this has happened to. So that's actually one of the most heartbreaking, but also, you know, building that resiliency in the kids that they got through this and it isn't great. And if they could choose it, they wouldn't choose it, but they're okay.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. It's beautiful.
That is, that's so important too. I know Allie and I talked about that quite a bit for anyone who is going through this journey. The awareness that you're not alone is one of the most powerful things. Cause like, you know, Connie's saying time heals. It does heal. Someone said to me this morning, I walked into the office and I said, happy Monday. Kind of wish it was Friday. And she's like, oh, don't wish time away. And I was like, you know what? You're right. You shouldn't wish time away. I'm sorry I said that. Cause I don't want to wish a single day away of this life because it's really precious.
I just want to clarify, because I don't want you to think that, you know, time makes everything better, because I will say in some respects, the longer he's gone, it's a little bit easier because, you know, you're doing whatever your new normal is for that long. But the longer he's gone, the more things he misses, right? So like my daughter just graduated from 8th grade. She's going to start high school. She's going to start doing these things. And it's just like the beginning of a series of things that her dad should be here for and he's not.
Yeah.
You know, so it's sad, and time makes it better because, you know, again, you become more comfortable in your state of whatever your newness is. But the moments, you know, that they should be enjoying together become, there are more of them. And that loss is something that, you know, they're always going to have. And so the sad thing is they have lots of opportunities to, you know, really sit with how that makes them feel and how they get through it.
Yeah. That is a really tough thing. I think those big moments, Allie talks about that a lot. The big moments are always really, really hard.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, I know we're running out of time, but has this affected your faith at all?
I would say no. So I'm Catholic as well. And honestly, I mean, total disclaimer, the Catholic Church is not perfect. We all know that, right? Human institution. But for me, my faith community, like, made us get through this. We mm-hmm. didn't have a choice. I mean, there were days that I woke up and things just happened for me. I have no idea who took my kids to school. I have no idea who took care of my dog. I have no idea who took out my garbage. I have no idea who filled my refrigerator with food, but all of these things just happened for me. Our school community, our parish community, they've just been great. Ryan was really involved in the men's club up at our school. So, I mean, after Ryan died, I guess I hadn't even mentioned this, I started a golf tournament. So we have the Ryan Roseberry Memorial Golf Tournament. The first year that we did it, I mean, we were able to fully fund a scholarship at our alma mater. You know, we raised just a ton of money.
So great.
The men's club golf league, like, they are now playing for the Ryan Roseberry trophy. So, like, the winning team at the end gets Ryan's trophy. So, I mean, we give out scholarships to eighth graders that are going to area Catholic schools just to keep Ryan's name out there, just to keep it connected to the community that gave us so much.
That's awesome.
One of the most touching things, you know, about our faith. So again, we have a really strong friend group. And so one of my close friend's daughters asked me to be her confirmation sponsor last year.
Aww.
And, you know, she came up and she asked me, she's like, well, you know, I'm just really struggling with whether I believe all of this or whether it's even worth it or whether it makes sense to me. She's like, and I saw, you know, what happened to you. And if you can still have faith and believe it.
Absolutely. The faith is so important, Connie. It's so important to have that faith in something bigger. It's huge. What an honor.
Yes, what an honor.
Yeah. That's awesome. Allie, did you feel like your faith was affected through this journey?
Yeah, in different ways. I also felt the power of the community in our parish, and it made me feel so much more connected to everybody. I've just been so thankful for everybody that has helped us. We are a younger family. So when Ross passed, I didn't have kids in the school yet.
Oh, yeah.
So that's been, harder because I don't feel like I knew a lot of people yet, but people now know our story and they have still reached out to me and tried to help with the kids. And it's grown my faith in people. And it's made me just, yes, believe so much more in the higher power and the good of people.
Well, but that's really what the church is, right? It's
right.
The people. It's the people. It's the community. Community. It's the people who have the same foundation, basis, mm-hmm. you know, values, beliefs as you. So,
yeah. And a little, you know, different perspective too. I'm not as faithful in organized religion. So for those of you guys who are in the same boat, you know, I grew up learning all the message and the foundational components of it. So I certainly understand that and appreciate that higher power. But, you know, if you don't have that faith in a higher power, there is still that faith that Allie talks about and I've talked about before in the universe and the people and the humans and the community that goes around it. And so for me, mine was about the community. It's my neighbors. It's my friends. It was the school. It was just all this collective of human beings. So, you know, there's so much good in finding that space that gives you that comfort and that community, whether that be through your church or that be through your school or your neighbors or your friends. There's lots of people out there who want to help us and want to connect to us. And humanity is so freaking amazing when you go through these journeys. So don't go away from it. There were moments that I was like, I don't want anyone in my face. But now I look back, I'm like, I wanted everyone and I still want everyone. And humanity is so good. And find that space that's most comfortable for you in this journey.
Right. I do want to say, because I don't want people to feel like my faith wasn't tested. 100% was. I want to be honest about that. And I don't want anybody to feel like that's not okay. Because I have 1000% questioned why, right? And I've been talking to a lot of my friends at my parish, and they said even Jesus did that on the cross. So it's okay to feel that way. Like, I feel like that's okay. So just want to throw that out there, that it's okay to question your faith.
Mm-hmm. And find your way back, right? Yeah. Ellie, you're right. Find your way back. Find your way forward. Find your way sideways, left, right, whatever that way is.
Whatever that feels right to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember one really good piece of advice that Connie gave me that's pretty special to me that I'm not going to share necessarily on this podcast, but I'm going to ask Connie to, before we wrap things up today.
Was it really good? What did I say?
Well, let's see. So a couple different things. Number one, I was complaining once because I had come home. I was having a bad day. And I'll be very vulnerable on this podcast. I always have been. I was getting off a plane for work. It'd been a long work trip. I'm driving home. My nanny hadn't done some stuff at the house. The yard was a mess. The trash was all over the place. It wasn't my nanny's fault. I didn't communicate well. It just looked awful. And I remember thinking to myself and talking to my best friend on the phone, if I could just drive my car into this fucking building, my God, I just am done. I had worked hard. I'd been through so many things. And I called Connie and she's like, stop. Take a deep breath and just pay for it if you need to have something done. It's not worth it for you to be this stressed.
Oh, yeah. That was the whole, you want problems money can fix. If money can fix that problem, pay for it. That's a, I mean, that's for real. That's good
right.
advice.
And sometimes it can't, right? Sometimes you don't yes. have it. And there's, sometimes there's things you can't,
there
or can't
do. There
are
problems money will not solve.
That's right. And so, but I just remember this, you know, that moment where I was like, okay, I have to do this. I have to stop trying to do everything myself. Let someone else do this. Just get through it. So. That was really a vulnerable moment for me, and vulnerable for me just to share that with the listeners that that's a feeling that you have.
Oh, see,
I've definitely had it.
I never felt guilty about that. Mm-mm.
Well, I'm talking about the feeling of just like, you know, like
wanting to end
like
it.
If you could just like take one simple moment and your mind goes to this fleeting space and then quickly back on track. Like, nope. Okay, Crystal, you're where you need to be, but it can get dark. And for you out there who are listening and just heard that, it gets dark and it gets light too. So that's okay. But Connie, what piece of advice would you share with our listeners to help them through their journey?
I suppose, I mean, while there are common components to it, I mean, whatever you feel is how you feel, and that's fine. Some days you're going to feel really great. Like, hey, I got this. I can take on the world. I can be all the things. And some days you're like, oh my gosh, I'm failing at everything. And all of those are valid. And they're all probably a little true, but they're all fine. And what other people think or what you think you should do or how things are supposed to be done or what it would look like if you were doing it better, none of it matters. And you really have to be okay with not caring what it looks like or, you know, how it's viewed from the outside. Because nobody knows what we're going through and what we have to deal with on a daily basis besides us.
So true. Thanks for sharing that.
Thank you.
And thanks for being here on a guest on the Hot Widows Club podcast.
Yes, please come again.
I was going to say, we haven't talked about anything juicy. Gosh, I know. I want to hear sad about stuff.
Right, we have so much more to talk about. Yeah. So Connie is actively dating. And so,
is that okay?
No, not actively dating.
Hey, Connie.
Connie dates one person.
Connie has dated, is dating one person. So
anyways. She's actively tried many times to sabotage and he just refuses to be sabotaged.
That's awesome.
We want to hear about this.
I know. Yeah, we do need to hear about this. Connie will be back for episode 2 of Connie here in the future. So
I am 2.0. A 2-part episode.
Yes, you are.
It's a lot for Connie.
Excellent.
Anyways, so signing off from the widowhood. The best/worst hood to be a part of. So I'm glad to have both Connie and Allie by my side. And I hope that we can have Connie 2.0 on soon.
Yes. Thank you so much, Connie.
Thanks for having me, guys.
All right. So as a reminder, please make sure you're checking out the Hot Widows Club podcast Instagram site, as well as our Facebook page. Or if anyone has any questions, comments, or would like to email us anything that's important to them, you can reach us at thehotwidowsclubpodcast@gmail.com.
We were also thinking about doing an episode of you guys ask us questions and we answer them. So if you guys have any questions about Crystal and I, about grief, about widowhood, whatever, email us and we'll do an episode on Q&A.
That's right. Thank you. Signing off from the widowhood.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi, this is Gus.
And this is Hank.
Hey, everybody. This is Allie. I have Gus and Hank with me. Just wanted to remind everybody that we have the Boxer 500 race coming up on August 21st. There's going to be a kids dash, a 1-mile walk, and a 5K run. Gus, Hank, and I will be there along with Crystal and her kids. So please come and join us.
Thanks. I'll see you later.
I'll see you later.